So last week, we began discussing the topic of Olam Haba. We had a very, I think, productive conversation, lots of good questions, perhaps fewer good answers, but that's the way of such things. And just to review some of the most important points that we said before we go on to new material, we started off by asking the question, should these matters be studied? We noted that the Rambam writes that the reason why the Torah itself does not elaborate on Olam Haba, spiritual reward, is precisely because it's something that is too difficult to really comprehend and to relate to, as we are physical creatures in a physical world. But on the other hand, we also saw that many sources stress the importance of at the very least knowing about these concepts. We saw the Mishnah at the end of Masechta Sanhedrin, which stated that a person who denies Olam Haba doesn't get Olam Haba because they essentially, among other things, deny that there's any form of justice. We talked about how the debate between Yaakov and Esav is one about a life and a world which focuses on the immediate, the present, versus the future. And we also focused on a very important element of Olam Haba, which is that Olam Haba is not meant to be a artificial reward, but rather a natural reward. To the extent that a person prepares themselves in this world, they will naturally be able to experience Olam Haba. We mentioned how some understand that on a more rational and intellectual level, like the Rambam, and others on a more mystical level, like in the Nefesh HaChayim. There's a joke which is still on last week's topic, which is a joke, but I think it presents this idea. It has, like good jokes, an element of truth. So the joke is that somebody was once taken on a tour of heaven and hell. So first they went to heaven, and they open it up, and what is there? A base medrash with everybody learning Torah all day and all night. So they said, this is heaven. So then they go on the tour of hell, and they open up the door, and what is it? It's a base medrash, people sitting and learning. So he said, I don't understand, what is this? It's the same thing. So he said, well, you know, if you like it, it's heaven, it's Olam Haba. And if you don't, it's hell. So the idea of that joke is an expression of this idea, namely that if a person develops themselves spiritually on this world, then they'll be able to enjoy the spiritual pleasures of the afterlife. On the other hand, if they don't develop themselves spiritually, then that very same spiritual existence will not be one of pleasure, but will be one of pain. So that is some of the ideas we said last week. Now, I wanted to start off with the questions that were bothering many of you, which I think we began to address, but elaborate on some of those points. And many of you were really bothered last week by the fact that the Torah does not state explicitly, if this is such an important principle, shouldn't it be written explicitly? So we began addressing that. One of the things that we pointed out is that the most basic idea of Olam Haba, what it is, and the details we'll get to later, but the basic concept is the Nitzchias HaNeshama, which means basically that the soul continues to exist even after it separates from the body, meaning to say even after death. That idea does appear many places explicitly in Tanakh, that presumption. One of them is the idea of kares, which is punishment of the soul, whether you understand it as the Rambam, as the soul not existing at all, or you understand it like the Ramban. But one way or the other, if the Torah tells us that there's such a thing as punishment of the soul after death, then there must be something as a soul after death. Another place where you see it is, the truth is, many stories in Tanakh presume the existence of the soul after death. Last time we mentioned the pasuk of V'haisa nefesh adonit srura b'tzror hachayim. Another example is the story with Shaul and Shmuel, where Shaul panics after Shmuel's death. He's about to go to war, and he somehow communicates with his soul. Now, that doesn't make any sense if the soul doesn't exist after a person dies. Another example is the soul of Nevas in the famous story of Karim Nevas tries to extract revenge on Ahav. We have numerous stories in Tanakh which again presume that the soul continues to exist. But it still does not say more, so the question is still there. Now, one idea that I think you suggested last time is that perhaps the idea is that this idea sort of evolved and developed over time, meaning to say that initially perhaps there was this very rudimentary concept of the soul existing after death, but certainly not something that was broad and sophisticated, and later on, perhaps because of other influences, because perhaps this was the influence, as you suggested last week, this developed. One of the interesting things, answers that I saw to this question over the week in preparing for today's shiur was the Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim, who ironically actually takes the exact opposite perspective. And it's a very telling idea. I saw that Rav Sadia Gaon also gives this answer. The Rambam writes that the reason why the Torah does not focus on it is because we have to remember who the Torah, at least initially, was addressed to. It was addressed to people leaving Egypt. So it actually sort of takes the idea that you said, but flips it on its head. The people leaving Egypt were extraordinarily unsophisticated, boorish, in the sense of religious development. They were idolaters. This is the way the Rambam presents it. They were coming out of a culture which was very much antithetical to the Torah. Now, we see that, among other things, in the fact that they were so frequently drawn after idolatry. A mere 40 days after Har Sinai, they have the story of the golden calf. And thus, the Torah had to reach them and attract them to Judaism. And it did so by focusing on physical rewards. And it did not do so by focusing on spiritual rewards, because this would be something that would be of no interest to them. It would be not some. It would not be something that would inspire them. On the contrary, it would be, if you told them that this religion doesn't offer anything in this world, but it does offer something after you die, so that's something that they wouldn't have been interested in. Now, this is an interesting, just methodological point. The idea that, on one level at the very least, the text of the Torah relates to the historical conditions of the time. Generally, we think of Torah as an eternal document, right? So, So generally speaking, we think of the Torah as eternal. Does this contradict that? So I don't think it does, because it's still saying that everything in the Torah is true. There are these physical rewards for doing mitzvos. It's true. In b'chukosai teilechu ves mitzvosai tishmeru v'nasati gishmechem b'itam v'nasna haaretz yivula. There'll be prosperity and the like. However, it's nevertheless also true that the focus was to that generation, at the very least. The Rambam actually says something here, and I'd like to actually return to this point a little later on in the year when we talk about tefillah and karbanos, but the Rambam writes that's why there's so much of a focus on karbanos and not a focus on tefillah and Torah Shebechtav, and that's because at this point, when they were steeped in idolatry, that needed to be the Torah's focus. And even if in a certain sense the Rambam here implies that tefillah is a higher service of God for the Jewish people leaving Egypt, the karbanos, serving God through karbanos, had to be the focus.
Had to be something that would reach them in the milieu that they were functioning.
Exactly. That's exactly what the Rambam says. So the Rambam suggests that is the reason for the Torah stress on karbanos, other things. This relates to the Rambam's general theory. The Rambam, in the third section of the guide, talks about the reasons for the mitzvos. He goes through and he offers reasons for virtually all of the mitzvos. Even things that are mysterious, like the Paraduma, the Rambam has a reason for it. Certain things, it's interesting. If I asked you, what would the mitzvah that the Rambam, most mysterious, that he couldn't figure out, what would it be? I would have guessed Paraduma, right? So the one that he thinks is the most difficult is the Lechem Apanim. The Lechem Apanim is the showbread in the temple. They had every week in the temple or the Mishkan, there was a shulchan, a table, and there were 12 loaves of bread. And the 12 loaves of bread would be replaced each week, and then they would be eaten by the Kohanim on that Shabbos and replaced with different bread. And the reason why the Rambam found this so mysterious, I believe, is because the Rambam felt that the more kadosh something was, the more it had to be removed from that which is physical. And this was something that was extremely kadosh because it was an avodas hapnimi, and yet it had the physical element of being eaten. And he found that so perplexing that he gives up. He raises his hands. But that's another topic.
And he cites that as his difficulty?
No, but that's what he alludes to as the problem. Anyhow, yeah, please.
So, it sounds like this would be a reasonable basis for the conservative and reform approach,
mm-hmm.
that if the Torah was written for that time...
Ah, excellent. Excellent. So, very good question. So let's, even though that is... That is not our current area of discussion, but let's talk about that for a minute. And perhaps we could return to it more in depth at a later time. So, just to continue, so what does the Rambam do? He offers many reasons for the mitzvos in the guide. And among them, he offers numerous sociological reasons and historical reasons, much of them having to do with the idolatrous conditions of the Jews at the time. Many mitzvos in the Torah have to do with idolatry and the like, and thus one could certainly reasonably ask, as you just did, you know, why in a world where idolatry is no longer what we struggle with, is there a reason for these mitzvos? So, first and foremost, we have to say that the Rambam didn't feel that this was the case. The Rambam, though he offers these types of reasons, writes in many, many places, clearly and unequivocally, that the Torah is nitzchi, it will never change, it cannot be added to nor detracted from. And that the reasons don't determine the parameters of the law. Meaning to say as follows, there's a discussion about this very question in the Talmud. There's a debate, and the debate is whether Darshinan Taima Dekra or Lo Darshinan Taima Dekra. What does that mean? One opinion said that we try to determine the reasons for mitzvos, and based on the reasons that we discover, those reasons will determine the parameters of the law. So, for example, the Torah says that you may not extract collateral from a widow. Presumably, the reason has something to do with the fact that she is poor. And therefore, one opinion in the Talmud, it's a debate between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, one opinion in the Talmud states that if the widow is wealthy, you can extract collateral because the reason isn't relevant. Let's imagine you have, I don't know, a very wealthy widow and she's borrowing money to repave the tennis courts on her beach house in the Bahamas. So she doesn't, you know, it's not talking about the Torah's type of loan. And so why can't you extract collateral from her? You know, usually the Torah always talks about widows and orphans as the most vulnerable people in society, and there are many, many protections that they're given. But this isn't necessary in this case. Why can't you extract collateral from such a person? And that's one opinion in the Talmud. The other opinion in the Talmud says no, that we can't use the reasons to determine the parameters of the mitzvah. Now, they don't actually say it the way I said it in this example, but that's their debate. So, we paskin like the opinion of Lo Darshinan Taima Dekra. We don't allow the reasons to determine the parameters. We assume, what's the reason for that? So, one reason, this is not the only reason, but one reason is that we assume that any reasons that we give, and the Rambam writes this, are speculative. they are guesses. And the Torah itself says and testifies to its own eternality. It says that you continue to have to observe the law. And a person cannot say, well, the law isn't relevant, it's not relevant. It gives, but the classical example of that the Talmud brings is the story of King Shlomo. King Shlomo said, well, the Torah said, do not have too many wives so that you don't go down back to Egypt. I'm sorry, so you don't, so they don't lead you astray. I'm going to have a lot of wives. They won't lead me astray. The Torah says, don't have too many horses because you'll be returned to Egypt. I'm smarter than that. I will be protected. I'll take care of myself. I'll take precautions. And of course, we know what happened with Shlomo. That was what led to his downfall. He started off in a very, very promising young monarch. He did not succeed ultimately because of those things. So the Torah tells us that while it's a good idea, now you might then go take to the other extreme and say, okay, so let's not try to figure out the reasons for mitzvahs, right? Since anyway, so the Rambam takes the middle approach. The Rambam says you should try to figure out reasons. And many different types of reasons are given. The Rambam, as I said, gives historical and sociological reasons. Others give, like the Sefer HaChinuch, give more pietistic and Musa reasons. But what the Rambam says is that even though it is true that it is a good idea to try to study the reasons for mitzvos, like he says at the end of Hilchos Me'ilah, for example, but nevertheless, you can't allow those reasons to determine the parameters, because ultimately the Torah is eternal and it reflects the divine wisdom. And unless the Torah itself gives limitations and says certain laws apply only in certain times and certain places, like it indeed does for certain laws, but if the Torah itself doesn't give those parameters, we as human beings don't have the authority to change that. So while the approach is very tempting and it even makes sense, one can't do that. And
that's the built-in pitfall, because if you start making assumptions and assume that we are in charge of the assumptions, then we might make wrong assumptions or extend the assumptions inappropriately.
Exactly.
Even if they were valid to start with.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yes, so you had a question.
Yeah. I don't find the completely satisfying the statement and the rationale for having to write the Torah for the generation that was the ones who came out of Egypt and were at Sinai, and maybe the immediate generations to follow, when you've had scores of additional generations, and the Torah, MS for
exactly.
the Olam, and they in their times had at least some aids that we don't have available.
Absolutely.
Moshe Rabbeinu, Hashem at Har Sinai, Hashem at Kriyas Yamsuf, where the Shivcha saw what Elio. Couldn't see. And then on top of that, that same kind of rationale I've heard given to explaining the so-called possible inconsistencies between Pshat in the Torah and creation, the way science understands it, saying that, Torah's not a history book, don't expect it to be, or a science book, don't expect it to be 100% factual. It was done for the generation of people and generations at that time. But on the other hand, it's Torah Sem, MS.
So
it's truth. So with God being the ultimate author of the Torah and his infinite wisdom, he presumably could have come up with a way of satisfying present generation and future generations for centuries to come.
Excellent. So first of all, I'm going to say at the outset that I do agree with your problem. I think many agreed with your problem, and that's why they offer different answers, which we'll get to shortly. I think that is a weakness. To defend that perspective, I would say that that's exactly what the Torah did. What you said is that the Torah should have come up with a way, God should have come away to be able to both address both that generation and future generations. And what the Rambam would respond is that's exactly what it did. That's why we have the written law and the oral law. The oral law does indeed talk about Olam Haba. It stresses it. It talks about spiritual reward. The basis of the oral law was given at Sinai along with the written law. Now, at a later time, I would really like to go through this topic. What was given at Sinai? What wasn't given at Sinai? What evolved and what didn't? But the basic notion is that, yes, our knowledge of this spiritual existence, which we call Olam Haba, is indeed rooted at Matan Torah at Sinai. It was part of the oral law. So the Torah did exactly what you asked, which is to come up with a way to both address the current generation and their needs, and that was done, among other things, by stressing in the written text the physical rewards, as well as to communicate the truth, which is that in addition, or primarily, the rewards that we're talking about are spiritual rewards, the rewards of Olam Haba. Still haven't described what Olam Haba is, but that's exactly what the Torah did. The Torah certainly is nitzchi, and it is certainly meant to be studied forever. And nobody would ever, ever imagine saying, well, we don't have to study the Torah Shebechtav because that was meant for that generation and the like. Absolutely not. Far be it from that. Like you said, it's Torah Hashem, and everything is in there is true. And that is true. What the Rambam is only suggesting is that the stress in Olam Haba reflects the needs of that generation and perhaps for many, many generations later, and that is balanced by the stress in the Torah Shebaal Peh. We have many, many times where the Torah Shebaal Peh and the Torah Shebichtav stress two different things, and when taken together as a whole, they present a complete picture, whereas each one on its own would present a incomplete picture, a impartial picture. I was just actually studying a topic today with my students in YU. A partial picture. A great example of this, which again is another topic I'd like to do with you one time. We were talking about the question of why the Jews were chosen. We're chosen people, why? What? And can
chosen
that end?
What?
Chosen for what? Chosen why? And one of the things we noted when we discussed this topic is how that if you, generally speaking, look at the Torah Shebichtav, you get one impression. And if you look at the Torah Shebaal Peh, you get a very different impression. Let's think about the chosenness of Avraham Avinu. When you look at the Torah Shebichtav, Avram is, the Torah does not tell us any reason why he's chosen. Avram is introduced with, Vayomer Shem al Avram, Lech Lecha Me'aretz Chakak. That's it. We don't know anything about his youth. It's not even like Noach. Noach, before God speaks to Noach, we at least see, Ela told us, Noach is tzaddik, tamim hayah b'dor asav, he was a great, great person, and then Hashem said, okay, you know, I'm going to save you. Avram, none of that. None of that. Later on, to be sure, we find out how great he was. But when he is first introduced, nothing, right? We don't know anything about his youth. We first encounter Avram when he's 75 years old, in the beginning of Parshas Lech Lecha. Compare that with the oral Torah. The oral Torah, we learn all about Avram's youth, how he independently discovered God, he was Moser Nefesh at Ur Kasdim when he was thrown into the oven, etc., etc.
What is the oral Torah? Is that...
It's all Torah Shebaal Peh.
Medrash?
Medrash.
Okay, but Medrash...
Define your
Medrash is not...
Medrash.
I am a... Medrash is part of the broader category of Torah Shebaal Peh. Now, again, I'd like to, and this I'm not going to do on one foot, but we definitely will do it. But Medrash, part of Torah Shebaal Peh, Medrash is part of Torah Shebaal Peh. Now, where Medrash came from, was it given at Sinai, how did it develop, and the like, it's a good question. Be'ezras Hashem, we'll tackle that issue. But the impression that you get from Torah Shebaal Peh, of which Medrash is a part of, the oral tradition is very different than the impression you get from the Torah Shebichtav. And the answer to that is that the two of them, now you still have to figure out why does the Torah Shebaal Peh stress one, why does the Torah Shebichtav stress another, but the two of them put together present the broader picture, which is, in my view, that there's a duality to the chosenness of Avram and a dichotomy and a duality in the chosenness of the Jewish people. We were both chosen for a reason, but our chosenness goes beyond a reason. There's an element of it which is inscrutable, and there's an element of it which is rational. The Torah Shebaal Peh gives us one perspective. The Torah Shebichtav gives us a different perspective. Both perspectives on their own are incomplete, and when put together, they represent and reflect the Torah's true vision. And if you have one without the other, then you simply do not have what is the Jewish, the position, the true position of the Torah, the true position of the Torah faith. We can't study one without the other if we are expecting to arrive at a understanding of Judaism. There's a value to study one without the other at times. There's a value, parshanut and learning the pshat is something that's extremely important. It's something that the Rishonim felt was worthwhile. But that is not give you the whole perspective. Just like when it comes to halacha, where we say that if you just had the Torah Shebichtav and you didn't have the Torah Shebaal Peh, you would come out with the wrong understanding of the halacha. You would think that an eye is, for an eye is literal. And you would think that you celebrate Shavuos on Monday, on Sunday, sorry, Machras HaShabbos, right? And you would think all sorts of things, which we believe are incorrect. We believe that the halacha could only be understood when you look at both the Torah Shebichtav and the Torah Shebaal Peh. So too, when it comes to hashkafic matters, when it comes to philosophical matters, the truth and the true position is only arrived at when you look at both together. And the same thing is true when it comes to Olam Haba. There is a different stress in the Torah Shebichtav, there's a different stress in the Torah Shebaal Peh. Why is that? One possibility is historical. Like the Rambam suggests, the Torah Shebichtav focuses more on that generation, the Torah Shebaal Peh focuses more on our generation. There are other answers why the Torah Shebichtav. The Maharal gives an answer. Rav Kook, fascinatingly, has a general insight to this. He talks about how the Torah focuses more on klalim, whereas the Torah Shebaal Peh focuses more on pratim. That's a broader topic. Pratim. Whether that's in the pratim of mitzvos, the details of mitzvos, or other things. The written Torah focuses more on the collective, and the Torah Shebaal Peh focuses more on the individual. There are many, many places in cases where we find that there is a difference in emphasis between the Torah Shebichtav and the Torah Shebaal Peh, so then we have to A, put them together to understand the true Jewish perspective, and B, we have to go ahead and ask, well, why is it that the Torah Shebichtav focuses on one and the Torah Shebaal Peh focuses on the other? That's true in halacha as well, by the way. The halacha is that when the Torah says ayin tachat ayin, it means mamon. It doesn't mean you pluck his eyeballs out. It means he has to compensate for the damage. Great. How we know that? The Gemara in Bava Kamma discusses. But ultimately, it's the Torah Shebaal Peh. But you then have to go back and ask the question, so why didn't the Torah say that? If it meant it, why didn't it say it? And when you learn Bava Kamma and you study the topic, you will understand the answer. It is a major theme in terms of understanding the Torah's nature of compensation for damage. And I don't know. I don't have plan to learn Bava Kamma maybe another time. Whenever you have these types of discrepancies, if you focus only on one and not on the other, you just focus on the Torah Shebaal Peh, and you forget about the fact that the Torah's formulation in Torah Shebichtav is ayin tachas ayin. So then you will have missed a major theme in Maseches Bava Kamma. We have two Torahs. Each one needs to be studied, and they have to be studied together.
And they have to be integrated.
Probably
something in the nature of like a fabric, where you have a warp and a woof, and if you have either one, you don't have a fabric.
Exactly. Some of the other answers, though, since you expressed reservation about this answer, the Rambam, and I totally sympathize with your reservations. So let me mention to you some of the other answers that are given. Again, some of these you might like, some you might not, some you might think sound apologetic, but I'll mention some of them. So one is an idea that which I alluded to last year, which Ramban and Rav Sag say, which is that it is so obvious that that the soul is eternal that it need not be stressed. We elaborated on that last time, so I won't go back to that answer. Another answer, which we mentioned last time, so I won't go back to that, is the Rambam. The Rambam says that the reason why the Torah does not stress Olam Haba is because if it did, that would become the motivation for learning, for observing the Torah. While it's true that Olam Haba exists, right? A person, Al Yomar Adam Hareini Osa Mitzvah Satorah, this is in Rambam Perek Yud Halacha Aleph, which you have here in your books. It is on Let's see. It's on page 10 of your source book. So why don't we read that together? Al Yomar. Page 10. I'm sorry. Take your time. The bottom right box. Al Yomar Adam Hareini Ose Mitzvah Satorah Beosek Bechachmasa Kadesh Akabel Kol Habrachos Haksuvos Ba. O Kadesh Ezkel Chayelam Abba. A person should not say that I am serving God in order to get the brachos or to get Olam Haba. The Rambam puts them together, by the way. A lot of times people think, you know, they see the Mishnah, Tiyuka Vadim HaMisham Shemesarav Al Menas L'Kabal Pras. Don't be like servants who just do it for the reward. So they think that means the physical rewards. The Rambam puts together Olam, physical rewards, with spiritual rewards. Olam Haba. And he says that this is not the right level. Just skip to the next halacha for what is the right level. Top of... Where were we? Oh. That was 10, so we have 11. Top of 11. Halacha bet. Rather, that is what the Rambam calls avoda meyira. So rather, what should you do? You should do avoda me'ahava. What's that? Ha'oved me'ava osek betoro v'mitzvos v'holich b'nesivos ha'chachma. A person who serves God out of love does Torah and mitzvos and follows in the paths of wisdom. Lo mipnei davar ba'olam. Not because of anything in this world. V'lo mipnei yiras hara'a. And not because of fear of evil, v'lo kedei lira shatova, and not be, in order to inherit good, ela oses ha'emes mipnei shehu emes. Rather, you do that which is true because it's true. V'sof hatova lavo biglala. And in the end, the goodness will come.
But then after saying, v'ein kol chacham zochalo, then he's willing to say, b'tol shalom v'shmabot.
Exactly.
And then after that, you wrap it up on page 12 with the opinion of Sotokot and Meruvin.
Okay, so let's talk. Let's talk.
Who's willing to bring aside, nenem ziv haspina is still mi'ahapa.
Right. So Reb Tzadok,
it's not an open and shut.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not an open and shut. Even so, let's make explicit your two qualifications. First of all, the Rambam clearly admits, and not unabashedly, that this is an extraordinarily high madrega, as the Talmud says, that li'olam yasok adam b'torah shalolishma umitoh shalolishma balishma. And the Gemara begins with li'olam. This is something that everybody has to do, certainly. Another reservation is the idea from Reb Tzadok, which you pointed out, the bottom of page 12, where Reb Tzadok distinguishes between wanting olam haba because you want reward, which is not the highest level, and because you long for Olam Haba, not as a reward, but as a reflection of your Ava, because you desire to be close to God, because you desire to arrive at the truth. Ava is about Emes, and Olam Haba is a place where a person can apprehend the truth. And that's true. I don't see that as a qualification. At first, I always thought that maybe Reb Tzadok was against the Rambam. But I believe now that is not the case. I think it confirms, it can work with the Rambam. I think the Rav said that. One place where you see it is the Rambam writes about how kama David, how David longed for Olam Haba. Does that mean that David wasn't Oved Me'ava? No, it doesn't mean that. It means that David longed for Olam Haba not as a reward, but as a place of apprehending the truth and closeness to God. Okay, but that is another reason why the Torah does not stress it. Another reason which is given is also offered by the Rambam, we saw that last week, that the Torah does not refrain from discussing unintelligible matters, at least the written Torah. Why is that? We can't understand Olam Haba, so it shouldn't talk about it anyway, or the way the Rambam put it is, talking about it will even diminish it. The Ibn Ezra focuses on this answer. Now, we have to ask, by the way, I don't remember if we did this last week. If we did, stop me. But the Rambam then says, well, what is the reason for all these physical rewards that the Torah does promise, right? If we're not supposed to long for it. And here the Rambam says a fascinating point. He says the physical rewards described in the Torah about prosperity and bountiful crops and the like, are not meant as rewards at all. The Rambam says the idea here, and if you want, we could read this Rambam inside. This is on can be found in Hilchos Tshuva, Perek Tes, which is on page 9. So that's the first point. Okay, excellent. So those are communal. You are absolutely correct. And that's another answer given to this question, that the Torah focuses on the collective and not the individual. The Ikrim focus on that. But the Rambam has a slightly different twist. He writes, Me'achar shenoda shematan scharan shel mitzvos v'hatova shenizkela im shamarnu derech Hashem ha'kasav b'torah hi chaye ha'olam haba shenemar l'man yitavlach v'arach dayamim v'hanekama shenokmim min harishayim shazvu archos ha'tzedek ha'ksuvos b'torah hi hi kares shenemar hi kares ti kares ha'nefesh ha'hi avona ba. Since we know that it's the spiritual rewards and the spiritual punishments that reflect the true rewards and punishments, ma hu zeh shekasuv b'kol ha'torah kula im tishme'u yagia lachem kach v'im lo tishme'u yikras chem kach v'kach. Why is it that we find that the Torah keeps on stressing these physical things? Kigon soveya v'ra'av, fullness or famine, u'milchama v'shalom, war and peace, u'malchus v'shiflos v'yeshivas aretz v'galos, v'hatzlachas maaseh, v'hefseido, v'shar kol divrei habris. Why is it? And the Rambam very briefly answers that these are not rewards and punishments. Rather, these are the Torah saying that if you do that which is right and you take advantage of the bounty and the physical goodness that God gives us to do that which is good and do that which is true and study Torah and do mitzvos, then I will give you more opportunities. And if you don't, you don't take advantage of those gifts, then I'll take it away from you and it will be harder. These are not rewards. These are simply saying, if you do a good job, you'll have more opportunities. If you don't do a good job, you won't. The Torah does not discuss reward at all in this concept.
It's something philosophical like schar mitzvah, mitzvah itself.
Exactly, schar mitzvah, mitzvah, schar mitzvah b'hai al-malekah. Exactly. The Gemara says Chayar Mitzvah, the reward for Mitzvah, Baha'i Al Malacha, does not exist in this world.
Oh.
Meaning, say, we aren't rewarded in this Mitzvah.
It does not, okay.
Mm-hmm.
More like the rewards are really enablers and the punishments disablers.
Exactly. Exactly.
We've seen some of that with Hashem's relationship to Paro.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a great example. Another answer, which we alluded to last week, so we won't return to it, is the idea that the Torah only promises controvertible rewards. Promising Olam Haba, promising something that nobody could actually witness while they're alive,
too abstract.
Is A, abstract, but B, there's no kunst to it, because maybe it's all made up. It's not something that we could verify or not verify. The example we gave last week, if someone was making up a religion, it's easy to promise heaven and hell. It's easy to promise something that can never...
Right.
That could never be seen. Another approach, which you alluded to, which I don't want to focus on today, is that the Torah focuses on the collective. Another approach, this is a very interesting one, is that prophecy focuses only on this worldly realities and not that which is abstract. And this is the Maharal's approach in Tiferes Yisrael Perek Nun Zayin. He actually addresses... No, I'm sorry, I didn't give it to you. That relates to the question that we address, which is, well, if it's so important, why is it in Torah Shebal Peh, not in Torah Shebichtav? And he says that the focus on Torah Shebichtav is different than the Torah Shebal Peh. The focus on Torah Shebal Peh is more of a this-worldly reality. Torah Shebal Peh, which is more abstract, which is not... The way the Maharal presents it is that any time something has to be written down into words, it becomes limited and finite. Words are limiting. They can't describe that which is abstract. Torah Shebal Peh had to be oral. In fact, originally it was oral. It was only written down because there was a concern that it would be forgotten. According to the strict law, it is prohibited to write down the oral law. The oral law, because it's not limited to words, can grapple with issues which are far more abstract than that which is written. And that's why it's in the Torah Shebal Peh that we see the focus on the abstract, the Olam Haba and the like, and not the Torah Shebichtav. Yes?
What about the two areas of Masa Bereshis and Masa HaMerkava, each of which also have some similarity to this topic in that they are very deep and you can get yourself in trouble by writing too much or stuff like that. And yet we do have quite a bit of specific writing in the Torah.
Okay, great. So I think that's
But we have the Mishnayos that say that restrict the mode and extent of teaching that can be done in these areas. So something similar could have been done here.
Good question, but I actually think the reverse. I think that this is a great manifestation of it. When you have the Torah Shebichtav's descriptions of Masa Bereshit and Masa Merkava, they're entirely physical. We have Maaseh Bereishis talking about what was created on the first day, second day, third day. Maaseh Merkava is a description of the chariots in Yeshayahu and in Yechezkel and what was on top of it and what shape the angels were in and what shape the throne was in and the like. They are not, it's only in the oral law, and here it's not in the Mishnah, but it's in the mystical teachings of the oral law, which were more hesitantly written down, but let's say the mystical, what became the mystical writings, where these are discussed in detail in the abstract sense. In other words, it's true you do have allusions, just like you have allusions to Olam Haba in Torah Shebichtav, but they're only allusions. You only have allusions to Maaseh Bereishis and Maaseh Merkava in Torah Shebichtav, and those allusions take on the form of physical manifestations of highly abstract and spiritual concepts. So I think that there's actually a very strong parallel in that sense. The final approach I'd like to deal with is probably the most difficult, which is good, because we have just a couple minutes left. The Gra and the Kuzari point out a very interesting thing. You don't have this here, I'm sorry. They point out that, first of all, we're missing the boat if we say that the Torah only focuses on physical rewards. It's not true. It's true at the beginning of Parshas Bechukosai. It says, I will give you rain and bountiful crops and the like. But read on. What does the Torah continue to say? V'nasati mishkani b'solchechem, v'lo sig'al nafshi eschem, v'hisalachti b'solchechem, v'hayisi lachem le'elohim, v'atem tiyuli la'am, ani Hashem elokechem, asher otzeisi eschem eretz mitzrayim, v'yos lahem la'avadim, v'ashbor ma'otosulchem, v'olech eschem komi miyus. The Torah here talks about the ability for human beings to commune with God, to achieve spiritual heights, even on this world. Hisalachti besochechem, I will walk with you. My divine presence will reside with you. I will allow you to cleave with me. The Torah does not just focus on that which is physical. The Torah says that the physical allows a person to achieve a high level of spirituality. And one final point, and this is an idea that will, I think we could perhaps later on in the year we'll have a whole topic about the philosophy of Rav Soloveitchik. But Rav Soloveitchik writes about, very frequently, this is a major theme of halachic man and the like. He writes about how halachic man does not think about Olam Haba. It's a distraction. It's not his focus. The Torah's focus is about us in Olam Hazeh, and how we perfect the world, and how we perfect ourselves, and how we improve the world, and how we improve ourselves. And the world is Olam Hazeh, and we live and occupy Olam Hazeh. And that being the case, so then the Torah needs to focus on Olam Hazeh. Of course it's true, and perhaps important to know that Olam Haba exists, but focusing on it will cause a person to miss the boat. Halacha is this worldly system. There's a very interesting passage in the Zohar which talks about how the Torah is the physical garments, the physical manifestations of abstract concepts. That's part of the idea of histakel b'uraisa bari alma, that the Torah, the idea that the Torah preceded the creation of the world. On one level, on its basic level, what that means is the Torah does reflect the ultimate truth, divine wisdom, but its presentation is a this-worldly presentation. It takes these truths, these very abstract concepts, and presents them in this world. When the Torah talks about the halacha, about when one ox gores another ox, that is a reflection of a deeper conceptual reality. That's true in the laws of torts, it's true in other forms of halacha, and it's true in this as well. And therefore, the halachic man is not one who thinks about olam haba, what it is, when it is, why it is. He focuses on Torah and mitzvos, on tikkun olam, etc., etc. And that is why the Torah doesn't focus on it, because it's dangerous, it's distracting, it distracts a person from its focus. Of course it's true, and it'll be there. But don't miss the boat.
Doesn't that bring us full circle back to at the start of last
yes,
week?
Yes, should we study these topics?
You know, why should we not even be
so
delving into this?
So maybe in that note, we'll call this topic a close. Maybe another time we could do it, and next week we'll go on to something else. If you want, we'll do free will next week. Okay? We'll figure out how to get back onto the schedule. As I said before, we'll be here this Shabbos. So I hope I see some of you over Shabbos. You're certainly welcome to the Friday night Tish and the Shiurim that we'll be giving. And
I just have to say, I'm not sick. The food system ensures.